If you believe that Judah and Jerusalem, spiritualized, become the church of Jesus Christ, then this chapter is about Christ and the triumph of his church and his kingdom. And that is what I believe, along with Calvin and Luther and Theodore Beza and Melanchthon and all these other chaps. The word which Isaiah the son of Amos saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. It shall come to pass in the latter days, or as the Hebrew says, at the end of days, that the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established as the highest of the mountains and shall be raised above the hills. And all the nations shall flow to it. And many peoples shall come and say, Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, and that we may walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He shall judge between the nations, and shall decide for many peoples, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. O house of Jacob, come, let us walk in the light of the Lord. Now, if you turn over to the book of Micah, you'll see that that prophecy is found there, although in a different context, and Micah continues the prophecy in a different way from Isaiah. In Micah chapter 4, it shall come to pass in the latter days, in the end of days, that the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established as the highest of the mountains, and shall be raised up above the hills, and peoples shall flow to it, and many nations shall come and say, Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, and that we may walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He shall judge between many peoples, and shall decide for strong nations afar off, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. Amen. And the Lord will add a blessing to the reading of his word and give us an understanding of it. I want this evening to start a new series of studies in the book of the prophet Isaiah. Now, as most people know, the prophetic books of the Old Testament are divided into two sorts. You have the minor prophets and the major prophets. The minor men are men such as Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Micah, and so on. And the minor refers to the size of the books and not to the insignificance of their message. They were all important and influential men, but they simply happened not to write long books. The major men are three. Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Isaiah. And these three major prophets are commonly singled out in this way. Jeremiah is called the weeping prophet. He was the man who lived before the final collapse of the kingdom of Judah. And he saw the end of the kingdom coming. He saw the deadness of the church, the awful formality of the worshippers. He saw the backslidden state of men and women who professed God's name. And he saw the worldliness of the priests and the ministers. He saw it all, and he knew that God could speak only in judgment to such a situation. And so Jeremiah wept. He is the weeping prophet. Ezekiel was the prophet of hope. He lived during the Babylonian captivity, during the 70 years when the Jews were living by the rivers of Babylon. And in Babylon, Ezekiel taught the people that God had not entirely finished with them. There would be a return to Zion. A remnant would come home to the land again. And from that remnant would one day be born the Messiah. And so Ezekiel is the prophet of hope. Isaiah is called the evangelical prophet because in him Christ is most clearly seen. He saw clearly the coming of the Messiah. And it would be true to say that you could preach most of the life of Christ, just using the book of Isaiah alone, even if we didn't have the four Gospels to tell us about the life of Christ, you would be able to preach Christ and his life from the book of Isaiah alone. For example, you find the virgin conception of Christ in Isaiah. Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son. You find the mighty works of Christ in Isaiah. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he hath anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor, to set at liberty them that are bound. Then shall the eyes of the blind be opened, the tongue of the dumb shall sing, and the ears of the deaf be unstopped. The mighty works of Christ from Isaiah. You find Christ's character and his meekness and his tenderness. His voice shall not be heard in the streets, the smoking flax he shall not quench. The tenderness of Christ's character. You find, of course, his great atonement and his death. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, yet it pleased the Lord to bruise him. Christ's death in Isaiah. You find the church of Christ in Isaiah, the church that Jesus died to ransom and to save. For the ransomed of the Lord shall rejoice and come to Zion with songs and everlasting joy upon their heads. They shall obtain joy and gladness, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away. The church of Christ. You find Christ's second coming at the end of the age. You find the dissolution of the universe at the end of the age in fire. You find the last judgment. You find heaven and hell, and all of that is found in the book of Isaiah. The whole spectrum of Christ's life and the spectrum of eschatology, the last things, can be found in this book. And Isaiah puts all of this forward in a most fascinating way. Right through the book, you have the interplay of light and of darkness. And that's how Isaiah presents his message. Light against darkness. Darkness against the light. Light trying to interpenetrate the darkness. And darkness trying to interpenetrate the light. And so the book, Light Against Darkness, Darkness Against Light, is divided into two very clear sections. If you read very quickly through the first 39 chapters of Isaiah, you will see that they are filled with darkness and with wrath. God's judgment on the nations. Babylon, Egypt, Assyria, they're all brought to the judgment bar of God in these first 39 chapters. You find God's judgment on a rotten church. You find nations being raised up by God to punish God's people. And then you find that the nations themselves are forced to drink the cup of God's anger and displeasure. It's all very dark, dark, dark stuff. And then the second half, which starts at chapter 40 and goes right to the end of the book, presents a transformed scene. Surely you remember how Isaiah chapter 40 starts. Comfort ye. Comfort ye my people. This is where Handel went to start his Messiah. Speak ye comfortably to Jerusalem. Or as the Hebrew says, come up round about the heart of Jerusalem. Say to her that her warfare is accomplished, that her iniquity is pardoned. And some have suggested that these two halves of Isaiah are so different that there must have been two Isaiahs. One, a rather severe man of judgment who wrote the first 39 chapters, and the other, a tender-hearted man of grace who wrote the second half of the book. But there really is no need to believe that. There simply was one man. But he was writing in different tones. And he was addressing different situations. I'm sure that you can write very different letters to the same person. You can write a severe, stern letter when the occasion calls for it. And you can write a gentle letter when the occasion calls for it. But you are not two people. You are one person. You're addressing different situations. My own particular feeling is that what you have in the first 39 chapters of Isaiah is mostly darkness shot through with light. And what you have in the chapters from 40 onwards to the end is mostly light but shot through with darkness. And what I would like to do up to Christmas is to look at Christ in Isaiah, and then after Christmas to go back and do some more general studies in this prophecy, picking out the great and the well-known passages. And so our theme now is Christ in Isaiah. Now, as you might expect, Christ is seen in many forms and from many angles in Isaiah. In the middle of the book, he crops up as the suffering servant of the Lord. And there's a wonderful series of poems in the middle of Isaiah. They're called the Songs of the Suffering Servant of God. And they're all about Christ. In Isaiah chapter 53, Christ is seen as the leper king, a man from whom men hide their faces, an outcast and an object of revulsion and horror, reigning from the tree. But here, in Isaiah chapter 2, Christ is seen in the glory of his coming kingdom. Chapter 2 is about the kingdom of Christ. And you could almost write these words at the top of the chapter. He shall reign forever and ever. Because what you have here is a Christian utopia, an evangelical utopia. The mountain of the Lord's house is exalted above the hills. The church of Christ is lifted up high, and nations and peoples flood the churches. And there is a desperate desire for God's ways and for God's laws. These things shall be, says Isaiah, in the latter days. And the question is this just a dream? Is this just a fancy? Is this just a fantasy in Isaiah's mind that at the end of days the church of Christ will be lifted up and millions will pour into the churches hungry for God's laws and God's ways? Shall these things really be? And if they're going to happen, when will they happen? Will they happen on our side of time? Or is this an eternal scene on the other side? When will the mountain of the Lord's house be lifted up and the peoples and the nations flow to it to learn of God and his ways? I believe that in order to understand this passage, we need to understand the nature of prophecy. And I also believe that we need to see that the key to this passage is the idea of the millennium, or the thousand-year reign of Christ, as it is sometimes called. Now let me just say a very quick word on the three very well-known positions regarding prophecy. And everyone here is in here somewhere. You are premillennial, or you're amillennial, or you're postmillennial. You may not be aware of such a thing, but I assure you, you are in there somewhere. I'm in the middle, if you please. I'm amillennial. Premillennial. Pre the millennium. Simply means that the people who hold that view believe that Christ will come before a millennium, or before a thousand-year reign. And this is a view generally held by most evangelical Baptists, by Pentecostals, by the Christian Brethren, and so on. And it runs like this. Towards the end of our age, there will be a great tribulation. There will be a falling away of many who profess Christ, and the churches will be empty. The love of many will wax cold, and there will be a time of persecution and of suffering for Christians, the likes of which has not been since the world began. During this great tribulation, there will be the appearing of the Antichrist, the man of sin, the false prophet. The world will be one nation, and it will be an empire ruled by one evil satanic government. The Great Tribulation will last for 7 years. In the middle of the 7 years, in order to spare his children more suffering, Christ will come back for his saints and take them away, and that's called the rapture. And then at the end of the Great Tribulation, at the end of the 7 years, Christ will come again to set up his millennial kingdom, and he will reign on earth for 1,000 years. And that's not the end of the story. At the end of those 1,000 years, Satan is released for a little season. And that release culminates in the last world battle, which is the battle of Armageddon. The battle between the forces of Christ and the forces of Satan. Christ is victorious, and thereafter that, you get eternity with Christ, the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. Now that, generally speaking, is the pre-millennial view of a prophecy. There are various variations throughout this, but that's the general view. And it is a pessimistic view. It is a dark view of the church and world history. According to it, this passage in Isaiah isn't about our side of time at all. It's only in eternity, when the King comes, that the mountain of the Lord's house is lifted up and the church is exalted high. Meanwhile, our job as Christians is a dark job. It's a question of picking out the remnant here and there from the darkness, the brands plucked from the burning. And that's the church's job. But the outlook is black. The middle of the road view, the amillennial view, is that the millennium is not a literal millennium of 1,000 years, but is symbolic. It's a round, symbolic number. That's what I believe. After all, if you're going to take the 1,000 years literally, then you've got to take all the rest literally too, including the dragon. You must believe in a literal dragon coming out of the sea. You must believe in a literal beast. You must believe in a literal 144,000 saved in the book of Revelation. You must believe in a literal scarlet woman sitting on 7 hills. You must believe in a literal lamb slain. But I believe that the millennium is a spiritual period, and that in fact we're living in it now. And it lasts from the death and the resurrection of Jesus until the second coming of Christ, which is the end of time. Satan is bound now. Jesus Christ reigns now. This is the millennium, and it will last till Jesus Christ comes. The third view of prophecy, and it's coming more and more to the fore amongst Christians, it's a view that has nearly always been held by our brothers and sisters in the Free Presbyterian Church. And it was held by many of the finest Puritans, both in Scotland and in England, including, I may say, Robert Moffat and David Livingstone. It's a view that is more and more espoused. And this is what it says. There is no need to postpone the promises of Isaiah chapter 2 to a far distant eternity. All of this happens on this side of time. There are better times coming for the Church of Christ. The better days are yet to be. Jesus Christ will yet triumph in the world and amongst the nations. And this view, the post-millennial view, is that Christ is reigning now. And as Christians, we have a right to take these promises of God and expect them to be fulfilled. And very often, Romans chapters 9 to 11 are quoted. And Paul says there that the Jews are to be converted to Christ. And that when the Jews are converted to Christ, there will be a great ingathering of the Gentiles. The Gentile nations will be evangelized by converted Jews. And so the last world revival has yet to be. And the church has yet to come into her own. The mountain of the Lord's house will be on the top of the hills. And the nations and the peoples will yet flow to the churches, hungry for God's laws and God's ways. And if premillennialism is pessimistic and sees nothing but a dark future of suffering and tribulation, then postmillennialism is optimistic and it sees hope for the Christian church. I'd like to read you one or two passages from Ian Murray's great book, The Puritan Hope, because this hope that the church would still come into her own is a hope that was taught by many Puritans. And Ian Murray, in the section dealing with Scotland's missionaries, he deals with the question as to why is it that Scotland sent so many missionaries into the world. The population of Scotland just now is about 8 million. At the period when Scotland was sending missionaries into the world, the population was only about 3 million. We were a very tiny, insignificant country. Now, why was it that we sent all these men and women into the world burning for Christ? It was because they were post-millennialists. And they saw the glory of Christ's church amongst the nations. And in this section dealing with the Puritan hope, that's the hope of Isaiah 2, the hope and Scotland's missionaries, he mentions some of the men in the north here who entertained that hope. There was the great William McBain, who was the minister of Alvis and had a great ministry. There was James Calder, who led a revival at Croy. And he says that the fragrance of James Calder's ministry in Croy was continued in that of his son, Charles Calder, who for 38 years was the minister of Ferintosh in Rosshire. And Charles Calder, that's the son of the manse in Croy, was popularly known as the piper with one tune, for he had only one theme in his preaching. All was subordinated by him to the great end of setting only Christ before the eyes of sinners. Well, I think that's a great compliment for any minister, a piper with one tune. But it's really Robert Bruce I want to speak about, not the king. I wouldn't have many kind things to say about him. He was a feudal baron and a bit of a gangster, really. History has romanticized him. But Robert Bruce, the minister of St. Giles, who was banished to Inverness because James VI didn't like him. James VI didn't like an awful lot of people, did he? Among whom was the minister of St. Giles. So James thought that Inverness was a wild and awful enough place to which he could banish Bruce. So he was imprisoned, and he preached quite a bit, traditionally on the site of the East Church now. It would be open fields then, but traditionally he had a wooden pulpit, and he preached there. And Bruce was a man, you see, who didn't espouse a dark outlook. He didn't come to the Highlands and say, oh, what a place, what roads, really. And what people, these wild clansmen, what awful people. He preached. He believed that Christ had a right to reign amongst these heathens. So, Murray says, even more remarkable was the effect which followed Bruce's ministry in Inverness, if you please, in the wild and Catholic Highlands, where he was banished there for the second time. He hadn't learned his lesson. In 1622. No great results appear to have marked his first stay in Inverness. But during the second period of imprisonment in the northern capital, a new day of blessing dawned in the north. Bruce sensed it, even as he made the difficult and weary ride to Inverness for the second time. On one of the last stages of the journey, he stood long and wrapped in meditation beside his horse one morning before mounting, that his companion later asked him the reason for the delay, and Bruce said, I was receiving my commission from my master to go to Inverness, and he gave it to me himself before I set my foot in the stirrup, and thither I go to sow a seed in Inverness that shall not be rooted out for many ages. Drink that in. I go to sow a seed in Inverness that shall not be rooted out for many ages. More than 200 years later, Christians in the Highlands could speak of the days when multitudes walked and took ferries from the counties of Ross and Sutherland to hear Bruce preach in Inverness. Speaking of Bruce's ministry in general, his contemporary David Calderwood says that he gained to Christ many thousands of souls. And another writer of the period gives one instance of a man who wanted to be saved. A poor Highlander, hearing Bruce, came to him after the sermon and offered him his whole substance, which was only two cows, upon condition that Mr. Bruce would make God his friend. Isn't that lovely? You do think it's lovely, don't you? You stopped listening. Came to the minister after the service with two cows. He says, I'll give you the two cows if you make God my friend. This was the first of the many revivals which were to make the northeast of Scotland one of the most Christian areas in the world. Later on, Murray goes on to speak about the Shotts revival, which occurred just about the same period. In fact, Robert Bruce went from Inverness down to Shotts in Lanarkshire to preach, and that was the start of the Shotts revival. Such was the hunger to hear the word of God preached in these times that weekday services became common. Dixon, for instance, held a communion service on Monday mornings before the opening of the market, and it drew many from the surrounding areas. For this market day, it is said, the church was even more crowded than on the Lord's Day. About the same time, this is in 1630, A service was held at Shotts, a parish midway between Glasgow and Edinburgh. You used to pass it on the old Glasgow-Edinburgh road. Of course, it's been bypassed now by the motorway. It was at the conclusion of a week of communion services at which 75-year-old Robert Bruce and others had been ministering the word. By the Sunday evening, such was the presence, a sense of the presence of God, that many were unwilling to go away. Actually, the minister there was pretty dreich. He was called John Livingstone, and he had a dry kind of ministry. He preached morality for a number of years, and the whole parish was very dry, as any parish is bound to be dry, sitting under a man who preaches nothing but morality. And the story is that in the vestry before the service, it was a wild night, John Livingstone had said, "It's enough a night of rain." And Bruce said, "We should be thankful that it's not fire and brimstone." And that was the start of the Shotts revival. By the Sunday evening, such was the sense of the presence of God that many were unwilling to go away. And thus, after a night spent in prayer, a further service was held in the morning. The preacher was the young John Livingstone, and the occasion he later remembered as the one day in all my life wherein I got most presence of God in public. There was a downpouring of the Spirit, he said, especially that sermon on the Monday, which I can speak on sure ground. Near 500 had at that time a discernible change wrought in them. Not to weary you with quotations, to go back to the Puritans. First of all, Goodwin. Thomas Goodwin. "There will come a time when the generality of mankind, both Jew and Gentile, shall come to Jesus Christ." That's what Isaiah 2 is saying. That's what Micah is saying. "He hath had but little takings of the world yet, but he will have before he hath done." And these words by Rennick, the Scottish martyr, James Rennick, who was martyred on the 17th of February, 1688. "There have been great and glorious days of the gospel in this land, but they have been small in comparison of what yet shall be." And I quoted Robert Moffat earlier on as the man who had the hope. He says, "I long to be engaged in the blessed work of saying to the heathen, behold your God. Do not think that the future scenes cast me down. No, behold, I go full of hope." What I would like to do is marry the pessimism of the premillennial people to the optimism of the postmillennial people. You see, you can get tribulation alongside revival. That's what's happening in the Soviet Union today. It's what's happening in Czechoslovakia and China. You get revival. And where you get the revival, you get the persecution. Why can't we marry the two views? Think of it, my friends. How many of today's regimes would be happy to see a spiritual renewal or a revival in their lands? I don't think Argentine would care for a revival. And I don't think Spain would like a revival. Nor would Nicaragua, nor Russia, nor China. How many of the rulers of today would like to see the earth filled with the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. That's the promise. Don't you think they might want to see the earth filled with the knowledge of Marxism? Or the views of Trotsky? Or of Jean-Paul Sartre? Persecution and tribulation alongside the promise that the mountain of the Lord's house will be lifted up and the church of Christ exalted. And peoples and nations pouring in to hear of God's laws and God's ways. The better times are yet to be, and the Christian church has yet to come into her own. And my good Christian friends, it will not come into her own without three things. And the first is prayer. These things will not happen without prayer. That's how the Lewis revival started. It's how the 1859 revival started. It's how the disruption of 1843 started. It's how the work of Wesley and Whitfield started. All of these awakenings started in praying societies, when men and women came together to pray for the work of Christ. Sometimes I go home on a Saturday evening with a very heavy heart. Sometimes I go home thinking of able-bodied young Christians in this congregation who are a great disappointment to me. As God is my judge, you are a great disappointment to me. I was converted 23 years ago, and friend, I got the message immediately. I didn't play with God or shilly-shally with Jesus Christ and the challenge of the cross, as some of you are doing. As God is my judge, you are a great disappointment to me. And I believe that you will have to answer to God for your shilly-shallying with the gospel message and the challenge of discipleship. This won't happen without prayer. Secondly, it won't happen without personal evangelism. How do you think the Church of Christ has survived in Russia? For over 70 years of Marxism and atheism and godlessness taught to the children in the schools, and the church has lived and grown. How do you think that has happened? By personal evangelism. Christians had a burden for their neighbors. They were hungry for the souls of their neighbors. This will not happen without that. And thirdly and lastly, it will not happen without a new kind of dying. What do I mean by that? Well, as Christians, we do lament the closure of so many churches, don't we? It's very sad to see so many buildings closing down. I was in Edinburgh for a few days' break. I was absolutely appalled by the churches that once were great gospel establishments. St. George's Parish Church, the bottom of Princes Street, just in from Princes Street, over towards Palmerston Place. That mighty monument. It's a library. Some of them are shells, garages, stores, furniture shops. And it's sad to see that. The churches are dying. They're not dying fast enough. Wouldn't disturb me if they all closed down. The real work of Christ would go on. It always does. It's not anchored to buildings. Maybe God will have to bring us down more. Down to nothing. He's done it before. Down to emptiness. Down to despair. The churches haven't reached that yet. They're so smug. Wouldn't worry me if God brought the church down to nothing, to emptiness and despair. The churches have to die. Christians have to die. And it wouldn't disturb me. After all, it is God's privilege to take death and make life out of it. It is his privilege to take nothing and make something. It is his privilege to take darkness and to make it light. These things shall be. The future is rosy for the living Church of Christ, not speaking about buildings. The mountain will be raised up. The nations will flow to it. Won't happen without prayer. It won't happen without evangelism. And it won't happen without death. May God help us all.